TechSec Twitter space on Sundays. Today we'll be talking about incident response planning for teams with a focus on ransomware to give an idea of to use that to demonstrate and discuss the different topics. Here's Sam. And for anybody listening to the recording, we'll get started here shortly. As I always say, just skip a couple of minutes ahead of time at a time until you hear the conversation becoming fluid. And Sam, I'm inviting you up, sir. Sam, did that work? There you are. Hey, how are you doing this
Hey,
evening?
I'm doing pretty good, Macaroni. How are you?
Doing good, man. Doing good. Hey, I've had a busy weekend.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The wife really wanted she, we went out and did some things. Bought a bunch of cigars to fill up my new humidor and
Oh, I know. I saw that.
yeah, man, that's was actually pretty. I was kind of mind blown by that because I just always had this little tiny box that my father-in-law gave me years ago, and I'm just kind of had some cigars in there, and I never actually had like a hydrometer in there or any of the humidifier stuff in there. And he's like, "Your
Right.
cigars are just dried out. They're horrible. What are you doing?" And I'm like, "I don't know."
Oh,
So, I've actually become pretty good with it over the last couple of months, so she thought she'd buy me that, and I enjoy it.
yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
Jo
good. Yeah.
yeah. Josh, do you want to hop up and speak? How are you doing, man? I think I've talked to you a lot on Space Place, if I'm not mistaken. You're welcome to request to speak. I always bring Sam up, but I don't usually bug other people. If you want to hop up, just request to speak. How was your weekend, Sam?
Oh, it was pretty good. No major complaints. Nothing like super crazy interesting. I mean, today, of course, a whole bunch of busy stuff with the wife and the kids, and
Yeah, Mother's Day, right?
So, but no,
Cool.
it was fairly relaxing otherwise.
That's good. That's good. We all need that downtime. One of these days, I'm going to take a week off of everything, but
I know. Yeah. Well, like a vacation, with just some time away. I mean, it is one of those things where probably less in many ways, or some ways, at least for me, than for you, because I know you've got a whole bunch going on with with your property that you do as well. But through the week, it's just like go, 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 go. Pretty much from like wake up to bedtime or whatever. And then on the weekends, it's all the things that like I didn't get done during the week. So it's kind of a similar thing, but just a different focus of either, like taking care of the lawn or the house or, running errands that I didn't get. But yeah, not, and it's, not it's a complaint or anything like that, but it's just
It's
it is what it is.
acknowledging the stuff you have to.
Keeps you busy. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I'm just do you guys mind retweeting? I'm actually gonna go ahead and get this retweeted out
Oh,
if you don't mind. Thank you, sirs. Let's see, tweet that. Now I'll go to my Holy Macaroni account and make use of that and tweet that out. Let's see here. Oh yeah, there we go. Always bring Holy Macaroni in here to make it look like, hey, look at all the people we have. Let's see, we'll get started here in a moment. Josh, we're going to be talking about incident response and planning today, kind of like how teams can prepare for and prevent incidents, how they establish teams, things like that. And if an incident does occur, right, say some projects or applications thing has an incident, whether it's a DDoS attack or ransomware or whatever downtime situation they have, what are some of the things to consider? So, that's what we'll be talking about today. Get this tweeted out. Okay, I got that tweeted out on both accounts. So so Sam, let me know what you think. But I think today I just want to more quickly go through the all the topics using your slides that you created for me, and
Sure.
at, like just quickly get through those and then find parts of that that we just want to have conversations about, because I feel like people join the space here when if they do later on in the space. So I'd rather be able to be at the point in that part where we can just have conversations and stuff about these different topics and just kind of get through the meat of it quickly and then do that, right?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Let's do it.
Cool. All right. Well, and it is recorded, right? So if anybody joins, go back and listen to the recording, right?
Yep. Well, and I mean, and also it kind of makes sense too, right? Because yeah, you're right. Like over the last 2 or 3 weeks, we've had people come in more, yeah, like I don't know, 15, 20 minutes in, right? So, but even if they do come in that point, also, right, hopefully they've either, seen the slides slash discussion in Twitter leading up to it, or they've gone and watched a video beforehand, so they already kind of. So yeah, I mean, I think like doing a kind of power through the slides, aka power through the topic of the week,
Yeah.
and then go into like the more open kind of discussion, thought, pseudo rambling but pointed about the topic makes a lot of sense.
Indeed, indeed. Okay, cool, man. Cool. I'm just gonna pin this up top here. I believe I have. Yeah, Josh and Codrock, welcome to the space. If you would like to hop up and request to speak and join, be a part of the conversation, you are more than welcome to do that. I don't bug people to, I don't request people to jump up to speak. I feel like that's just bugging people. So if you want to hop up, you're welcome to request it. But Josh and Kadarak, what Sam and I are going to do right now is, like he said, power through the topic here and then have a conversation. But Kadarak, for you, your knowledge, what we'll be talking about is incident response planning, how teams can practice proper incident response planning, preparation, building the teams, things like that, and how to handle an incident if one were to occur in any kind of attack it may be, right? If an API is compromised or they're DDoSed or ransomware, whatever it is. But I'm going to go ahead and get into it. Sam, do me a favor and interrupt me at any point while I do power through the slides. If you think I've powered through fast enough, too fast, and missed something, and then after that, we'll go ahead and just open it up for conversation and let everybody pick something that they want to dig further into. So
All right, sounds good.
awesome, awesome. So without further ado, again, this is incident response planning. And by the way, I have and I'll let Sam, you're welcome. To give your experience if you so choose after I do, but you don't have to. But my experience with this is I have spent a very long time in cybersecurity, and one of the things I do is support forensics teams and incident response teams and helping do the forensics, pull images, gather information in the environment, ensure the security solutions are configured right based on the incident you're having, all this stuff. So I've dealt with many, many ransomware cases. And I'll start off by just kind of mentioning, like, actually, we'll save the ransomware part for some other point, but it's very interesting. It's actually not that interesting, but it is kind of mind-blowing what actually happens in a ransomware case. And it's not really the ransomware, but we'll get into that. Anyway, the first thing is really the setup and the process flow. So what you have, so he, here's how the flow generally works. You have the cybersecurity incident, the incident that occurs, right? Something happens. So actually, I guess I will get into it right now. So say the customer gets ransomware. That's kind of the first step, but it's really like the middle step. So what then will happen is the company or customer or whoever says, okay, I have ransomware. Now I need to reach out to my cyber insurance people if I have that. Simultaneously, they're reaching out to, depending on the industry they're in, they might be reaching out to their attorneys or somebody like that, right? So they're reaching out to insurance and attorneys. Also, simultaneously, they're reaching out to a forensics team, an investigation team, right? And it's an incident response team. So, from my own personal experience, generally what happens, they call us and say, hey, we need you on the phone here in 5 seconds. It's usually about 9 p.m. on a Friday. Pretty much everywhere in civil cases, about 9 p.m. Friday. They say, hey, we need you to come in. So we'll come in, we'll jump in throughout the weekend, we'll slam through a bunch of stuff and get a lot of good stuff going. And then maybe Monday comes, and if the customer has cyber insurance, a lot of times what will happen is the insurance will say, no. You can't use them for the forensics part. You have to use these people in order to get paid out. So then what happens is they split it off and say, well, you guys can work on the security solution stuff, but we kind of have to have these people do the forensics part. Now that customer is starting back from ground zero, essentially. So they're already kind of a couple of days behind at that point. Also, I've seen situations before where they'll have their legal teams or their attorneys. So we'll then jump into something called attorney and client privileges. So when that happens, then that customer also has yet another hurdle and bottleneck. These are good things, right? The insurance attorneys are great things, but it's good for people to be aware of, if they do have those things in hand, the potential hurdles they'll face. So with the attorneys, I've seen scenarios plenty of times where I'll have to tell the customer something or ask them something, and I'll have to tell our attorney. Then that attorney has to tell their attorney. Then their attorney tells them. Then they respond, and it goes back to their attorney. That goes back to our attorney, then back to us. So it's usually about a day and a half turnaround for something. In a ransomware case or any kind of an incident, that is a terrible situation to have to deal with, right? But then, so anyway, those are things to think about when you really have the beginning process flow of any incident, right? And I'll probably talk more about that as I go on. So continuing that, right? So then you also have your response teams, your incident response teams. So you're typically looking at a few different things. You're determining, maybe your support desk IT people have a different role in an incident response. Or you have, typically you're also defining who your communication people are, right? Who's your public relations folks? Because you're typically relaying different information depending on the audience, right? To your internal employees, or to maybe your own customers, or to the general public, right? You got to be, there are obviously different types of communication going there, because you need to be careful what you're saying, because you don't want to alert the bad actor to the knowledge you have of the attack, because then what they'll do is change paths and attack you in a different way once they realize you've caught on to what they're doing. And I've said in my video, I've seen that happen a lot in nation state attacks specifically. But going back to the ransomware scenario, generally the first thing that occurs is, not the ransomware, but it's 8, 9, 10 months before that, an employee got phished via email. 99% of the time, that is exactly what happens in a ransomware case. I promise you. Then the next two things that happen is that that bad actor, once they've gained those elevated privileges, they'll start pivoting around the environment, gaining elevated domain credentials, domain administrator credentials, things like that. And for mainly the purposes of two things: finding where all of the critical business functions and information is, and then finding that company information so then they can data harvest that information. So then they can use that as possible leverage if you decide you're not going to pay the ransom for the decryption keys, because you have your stuff backed up, right? So you tell the bad actor, I have my stuff backed up, I'm not going to pay you for that. And they say, well, I have your information, I'm just going to release it to the public, right? And I think, and I like to bring this topic up a lot, because I think that it's something that people in our blockchain world neglects a lot. And I personally believe that's eventually going to be a thing that happens in our space. And it's going to hit blindside people, and it's going to be a big ordeal. But yeah, maybe not that, right? But I think it will play some impact. Anyway, moving on. So you have the attacker process flow. You have And I'm getting very long-winded, Sam, so I'm gonna go back to the powering through this. I'm not doing a good job at that. So I've already talked about the attacker process flow slides. I'm gonna skip that. So okay, so there's four phases to an incident. So or an incident response plan. First of all, you have the preparation phase. You need to be aware of your threats, assigning your different roles for the incident response team, like I talked about. You'll need to define your policies and procedures, the different employee tools and security solutions you're using, as well as conducting your training and support awareness for your employees, because of what I mentioned about that employee phishing email situation that generally happens in ransomware cases. Then you have the detection and analysis, where this is kind of the ongoing thing forever. In your preparation phase, you've decided these are your security goals. So these are the solutions you're going to use to for the detection and analysis, right? To maintain a secure environment, as well as like identifying the bad stuff going on in your environment, so to speak, when an incident occurs, right? And you'll need to focus on your threat research, your secure code review. That's ever an ongoing thing that should always be happening. Your vulnerability assessments, penetration testing, and your prevention, like I talked about, having your different solutions, whether it's centralized logging or you have a security operations center or your standard antivirus or EDR or MDR, right? Event detection and response, and then or MDR, managed detection and response, right? Stuff like that. There's a lot of different things there. So you have the third phase. This is when an actual, and by the way, I'll pause for a moment. Sir Corin, I see you hopped up or jumped. You're in the space. You're welcome to request to speak if you'd like to hop up, man. But anyway, so the third phase of an incident response plan is the actual incident itself. And the actual incident has three major phases in itself. That would be containment, eradication, and recovery. So ransomware, you identify you have ransomware. The very first thing you need to do is contain that ransomware, prevent it from spreading elsewhere. You're generally locking down parts of your environment. Maybe you're taking an entire data center offline. Maybe you're disabling domain administrator accounts, or you're rotating your golden ticket, or all these different things to you're really trying to stop it in its tracks, right? Once you've done that, now you get into the eradication phase, where now you've kind of got everything under control. Now you're trying to find out where everything else is living, right? And removing that completely from the environment. Then you have your recovery phase. This is when you're going through restoring the environment back to where it was, right? That kind of thing. And then you have phase four. This is the post-incident activities, right? You're going through your post-mortem, your action plans, your lessons learned, you're deliberating, and you're still providing that communication, whether it's internal, public, or to your regulators or whoever, and deciding what communication you're going to provide to each set of audience, right? And it's not to hide anything. It's to, there's a bunch of reasons, right? You want to be careful of the fear, mentality you might impose on people's minds by sharing information in the wrong way. If you're still potentially not sure you're secure, you're still worried about alerting the bad actors. There's a lot of reasons, right? But yeah. Now, what this business continuity. So all of these things in this list is all encompassing under a business continuity plan, right? It's the overarching thing. The policies and procedures I talked about in the very beginning, defining the teams that's going to work the incident, what tools and solutions you're using, how you're going to manage the incident, how you're going to communicate, all of these different things. Then you have the disaster recovery phase or disaster recovery process, which is really a supporting component of business continuity. It's a very specific part of determining what servers and what infrastructure is critical, is designed for critical business functions, and how you're going to restore all of that in a very rapid manner, right? Maybe you have a disaster, maybe you have a backup data center that's specifically pre-staged with these things to automatically come back up in the event the primary goes down, or a lot of different examples. But yeah, I'm going to go ahead and stop there. I'm not sure. I think I just got extremely long-winded there. I don't know if I did a good job rapidly going through that. But anyway, I'll open it up to the floor. Sam, you go ahead. If anybody else wants to hop up and speak, like I said, go ahead and request.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that was I think that was good for a rapid fire through the process, right? And recapping it, I mean, there's definitely a lot that could be broken down for each of the different phases or elements. So I won't go through all of my notes right away, just in case, you know, I saw
Yeah, just pick one and we'll have a conversation about it. Yeah.
Sir Corin, yeah, went up, but you probably know, right, what I'm gonna say first, and that is like being a GRC nerd in cyber, right? A lot of this comes down in my mind to the preparation, the prevention, and like how you're even just setting it up from the beginning. And so, you know, that comes down to policies and procedures, and just for anyone here or listening later, right? Like the super short of that is a policy is your overarching guidelines. It might spell out what, you know, what the business objectives that you're trying to enable or protect. Like it's the overarching document that's going to guide like what the incident response is going to entail, and you know, it's going to set up like who's on the IRT. And then you have your procedures, which are the actual how do you do it, right? How do you respond? How do you prevent it, right? Would probably be in there, should be in there. And then also like how do you identify and respond? And then based on what kind of incident it is, like what the attack modality is, how you're gonna respond to it, and then follow through all the plans. So policy, high level. And then, you know, procedures are going to be like your step by step. But, you know, I think that's one of like, that's for me, the ground work that needs to be done. Because if you don't even understand what your business continuity plan or your disaster recovery plan is from a policy level, then I think, you know, when something happens, all of the things that you've said, right, through all the slides and all the different points, they're going to get lost or they're going to be less coherent as you're going through it, right? You're not going to have that clear framework for how are we going to respond, and what are we going to do? And the reality is, right, like there's probably daily, you know, especially in larger organizations, if you are logging, correctly, then you're going to have a lot of activities that come up. And so being able to triage those at a human level of, you know, which ones you should take note of and what the response to them should be is an important thing to kind of focus on. And again, that should be spelled out probably in the procedures, right? And that might include your wake up criteria for, you know, when one of your techs, whoever is responsible for managing it, right? Like who will they bring it to? Like what type of incidents do they elevate it to, right? Like in other words, who, you know, when is it a Slack or an email to the incident response team lead? Or to the CISO, if that is a position in your organization, or the CIO, or CTO, depending on how you're set up, right? Or like what's wake up criteria for the CEO, or right on a smaller project, like just the person kind of overall in charge. But I think it really starts with those policies and procedures. And what I would say on that is, right, because some of this conversation is, you know, you could be a very small team, you know, of like just a handful of people working on a project in Cardano or in the greater crypto space. And, you know, so those roles might blend together a little bit more because they're just, you know, everybody's wearing multiple hats in a small or medium business. But still, right, having that discussion, having something written out, right? And I would say getting, like, having the discussion and writing it out. I'm sorry I just repeated that, but right, I think it's still important, right? I would not focus so much on like, oh, well, I don't know how to write policies, or policies are and procedures are so restrictive, and we like to do things a lot more ad hoc or, laissez-faire. But like, I think having that discussion and knowing, hey, what is it that we're looking at, and what's important to protect is, I think that's got to be in the first discussion. And then, because that's going to help drive what your response is going to be. And also realizing, right, like all of your best preventative measures, you're not gonna, it's infeasible to stop every possible attack, right? And so eventually something will happen of some degree of severity, right? It but it could be a lower level, credential compromise or something like that. Not that those are not important, but like versus, your whole system got ransomware and all your data was exfiltrated, by an attacker and on and on. So, but yeah, but I think the prevention is key no matter how large your operation is. And I'll pause there for anyone else who has a, yep, go ahead, Sir Corn.
Actually, Sir Corin, one second. I'm really interested in what you have to say, but there's two things I think we should, based on what you just said, Sam, that we should probably drill into a little bit more too, is two things that I think a lot of people miss when they're doing this is normalization. You kind of alluded to it, right? And then tabletop exercises as well. So once you define your policies and procedures, every periodically, couple of months or every few months or something, get all of the players, even if you're just a team of five people. Get them all together on a call and walk through potential scenarios so that they're, and this is something you do in the military all of the time, right? You practice these things. So when you actually have to do them, it's almost like it's just, I forget the term, just a natural thing to do,
It's second
right?
nature,
Second nature. Exactly. Yeah.
or it's a
Because if you just create
well-oiled
this stuff and then,
machine. Yeah.
well-oiled machine, absolutely, right? Because if you just create it and set it aside and 2 years later you have an attack, nobody's going to know how to do it. For one, everybody's
Yep.
going to have will have forgotten. Two, you probably have had some relative turnover, right? Also normalization. So a lot of I see a lot of people set up, they'll set up, or whether it's open source or purchase, they'll have all these different security solutions pulling in all of these different events and all throughout the environment. But they don't really know what's going on. So you really need people that are able to watch that traffic. And I for an easy way of saying it, understanding what normal traffic on a day-to-day basis happens in your environment, so you can much more quickly pick out something that could be potentially malicious, right? Or a potential compromise. So you can say, hey, this event here isn't very normal. I need to look into it, right?
Yeah, and
But
that's definitely something, I've heard of that, described as the baseline, whether that's a network or whatever else it is. But yeah, you get your baseline, so you understand what does normal look like, right? So it's easier to get it. But no, and I won't go too much longer on this than what you said, because I think you hit a lot of it. But yeah, no, absolutely, like doing training, like, and that's in your slides, I'm pretty sure. But like doing ongoing training with the IRT, with the incident response team, and then doing those tabletop exercises is absolutely important because, right, like you said, right, you've got to, you have to continue to make sure that the team remembers what they're doing. It may help if you have a clear procedure spelled out for what you're going to do, but even still, right, you still want to get them together on a periodic basis when there hasn't been an incident, or even if there has been, right, and continue to do those because it's not a one and done. It's not like you set your Whatever your plan is, right? You don't just set your plan up and then say, okay, we're good, right? Now we'll be prepared. And then you never come back to it. And people, like you said, right, they forget about it, or they don't really understand it because they haven't done it, either A at all or B in, a while, whatever that length of time is, in a quarter or semi-annually or whatever. But it also doing the tabletop exercises, just running through a drill, right? So that's like where you just, you say, okay, here's a scenario. We, had, credentials compromised, or we detected an incident, or whatever the case may be, right? You pick a scenario, and then you run down what your steps to respond to that would be. But in doing that, you may realize, okay, right, this actually doesn't work, right? Whatever we said in the plan, that isn't going to work, or it's not the most effective or efficient way to do it, right? Or whatever the case may be, you find an error or something that could be fine-tuned, and then you refine your plan, even in the absence of a real event. So,
Absolutely, absolutely. All right, so Corin, sorry for us jumping ahead of you. What do you have?
yeah, no worries at all. Yeah, I don't know if I'm gonna be like super helpful because I'm a pen tester, not like an analyst or a
Well, I think you
instant
bring a
responder.
completely different per I think you bring a different perspective, not to interrupt you, and I think what anything you have would be valuable, but go
Oh
ahead.
yeah, for sure. Yeah, I was gonna say I've probably caused more incidents than I've helped resolve, but yeah, I think Sam, you were talking about like detection earlier, and I was just gonna say the kind of cliche phrase that I was taught and I learned a lot of times is that prevention is ideal, but detection is a must. All right, like one of the worst things you can find out is the bad guy's been living in your system for months or years. A lot worse than just seeing the logs like as they're trying to attack and get in. You could stop it right away. So you typically want to measure things in like, in cybersecurity, anything can be hacked, giving enough time and resources, right? But you generally want to measure it in hundreds or thousands of years or trillions of dollars. Like if you've got this, crazy system that, it can be hacked, but it takes 100,000 years to do so, it's probably not reasonable to assume that it's probably not worth the effort, right, to the bad guy to deter them. So yeah, that's kind of my two cents. I think the other thing you're talking about during the beginning when you're going over like kind of the phases of incident response, kind of the DDIs to remember things as Pickerel, preparation, identification, containment, eradication, recovery, lessons learned. And then like the two first one, preparation and identification, they're like kind of a continuous feedback loop. And it's like only when the incident first gets detected, you move into the final four phases. So that's kind of my two cents.
That's a good point. So, Corin, I would actually, not to put you on the spot, and you don't have to, but from a pen tester perspective, if you had to suggest some tools out there for some of our crypto teams with small teams and low allocated funds, that kind of thing, what relatively free or relatively free solutions, if you have any, might you suggest to people out there?
So one of the things that's fresh on my mind is like, I mean, I guess probably not every team is using any kind of like Active Directory LDAP database, but large enterprises are typically using some form of Active Directory and just running bloodhound against your own systems all the time to see what kind of kind of escalation can be done towards domain admin. And there's blue team versions of Bloodhound as well, like Plumhound and Bluehound, I think, that kind of give you like reports pages on your different kind of configuration mistakes that could be exploited. That's probably the top one off the top of my head.
Very cool. Very cool. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I guess another one would be to actually like what you guys were talking about before, like actually practice your response plans, your BCDR incident recovery, like worst case scenario recovery stuff on a regular basis. That would probably be another big one because those happen. Like people never expect those things to happen, then they do, and it's a disaster. So.
Yeah, I cannot tell you how many incident responses I've been involved in where the customer just says, "Hey, tell me what to do." I'm like, "What do you mean? You don't have a plan?" No.
Yeah, that's
Okay.
definitely not what you want to hear. No,
Yeah.
that's not. Well, and there was, yeah, I mean, no, it's, I came into an organization a few years back, right? And it was like, again, being a GRC person, right? Governance, regulation, and compliance, like IRT is so fascinating to me, and like BCPs and DRs. And I, you know, so I came in, I was like, oh, you know what, you know, can I see your disaster response or your business continuity plan? And they showed it to me, and it was like last updated 5 years ago. And the other thing I would say in it too is it was all IT based, right? So like when I was reading through it, like there was nothing in there about other business operations areas. Like there was nothing in there about HR. This was a healthcare organization, so there was nothing in there like from the HIPAA compliance officer or other areas other than just like strictly within the IT department. I was like, okay, this is going to be fun. To go through and update it and like actually get people involved for, you know, what we're looking to protect. But
yeah. Yeah. Not to derail the conversation, just a quick break to mention that I did pin up the tweet up there that has all of the slides for this topic that Sam created for me, as well as in that first tweet of that list of tweets is the link to the YouTube video that I did earlier this week on this topic. And if you go for anybody interested more in this, there's a whole bunch of links I put in the description of that video around, you know, understanding IR planning, forensics tools, awareness training, DevSecOps tools, Burp Suite, Zap, MITRE attack framework, stuff like that, OpenEDR, AWS security, you name it. So, you know, check that out. If you guys have anything additional that I should add to that list, I'm always willing to update it. This is not for me to, I never consider this a thing for me to share my information. It's to provide value to people. So if you guys ever have anything that I should change or add or whatever, I would appreciate your time in providing that to me. But yeah, check that out if you want to. Anyway, we can continue. Jarhead, thanks for joining, sir. You're welcome to hop up if you would like. I know you're just in another space. Actually, that's a pretty fun space. I couldn't stay in there long, but anyway, back on track. What might be another topic? I think we're just kind of jumping around at this point, which is great because it actually feels like a conversation. I don't have my slides up anymore, so I can't pick one. You go ahead, Sam.
Yeah, I mean, for one more, maybe just to, and I don't know how long to go on about this, but I mean, one thing that Sir Corin said, you know, is absolutely true too, right? Like there are, and that's the time an attacker is in your network, right?
Indeed.
Can vary widely, right? I have seen, you know, that some attacks or breaches, incidents, if you will, are just that they're identified in 11 to 24 days. And I think that's beautiful. But like Verizon and their DBIR, and I think IBM in their last for 2022, right? They both kind of mentioned, you know, much longer, like 200 plus days. I want to say like 240 days was like, you know, one of the trends that they saw of people where attackers were inside a network, you know, doing the pivoting, the harvesting, the gathering of information, and the exfiltration of data, like for up to, you know, 200 something days before detection occurred. And if you look back, you know, historically, like you look at the OPM, right, the OPM hack of, and I know this is like a little bit of a longer one now. When was that? 2015 or something, but like, but that one was, it was like almost 9 months. And of that, you know, it was like 2 or 3 months where they even knew the attacker was in their system and had left and like come back in through another entry point that they had created while they were in the first. It was like so crazy. But then for LastPass, if you read theirs as well, I want to say it was not that extreme, but it was, I mean, LastPass was just last year, right? And LastPass are, for all intents and purpose, right, they're a high quality, security minded technology company. But if I remember correctly, even for their data breach last year, it was still like months that the bad actors were in their network, gathering information and exfiltrating vaults before they were detected. And then they had a secondary attack in a totally different area when, and I forget if he was like their lead,
It was their lead dev, yeah.
Yeah, who on his personal laptop at home had his credentials hacked, and then that's where they got, you know, a whole bunch of decryption keys and other things out of their proprietary GitHub, right?
I don't like it interrupting, my apologies, but yeah, to your point, it was actually he was compromised via his Plex server, which is right. And to your point, real quick, I'll let you continue. But yeah, just to add to your point, I can tell you that almost every single ransomware case I've been in, for as a perfect example, are almost identical, where 8 to 9 months before that, one of their employees was compromised, right? And then, and to your point, that bad actor took those initial credentials, gained elevated credentials, and started pivoting around the environment for months and months and months, data harvesting and doing all of that things, and planning other attacks. And another thing to your point, right, in nation state attacks, right, this happens all of the time, where like you said, right, they'll have other attack methods already pre-planned. So then when the moment they realize you're on to them for that current attack, they're going to pivot and change it and continue attacking you in a different way, right? But go ahead, not to steal your thunder there.
No, that's excellent. I mean, and I wouldn't add too much more just to that one. I maybe 2 points, and right, like, so almost half of the attack vectors are phishing, right? I think it's like in the 40, like mid 40s. I forget the exact number, but it's somewhere in there that are phishing attempts. And maybe this is a little sideways on it, but I mean, you know, I would put in there social media or other kind of compromise falls slightly into there, right? And there may be different elements to that, but like, you know, Discord, Twitter, aka the Twitter word, right? And that's maybe more for your personal account, but there's still a lot of data that could be extracted from your Twitter account that you wouldn't want. But that's one part. The other part too is I think it really ties in when you look at the containment and eradication, right? If you're able to catch them in, you know, 11 in within a month, right, or a few days, you know, it's not that a lot of damage can't be done. It certainly can, when you're talking about if they were in your network somehow for months, and then you finally detect them, right? That containment and eradication is going to be, it's going to be a mess. So,
yeah. What's up, Jarhead?
Yeah. Hey, fellas. I have a quick question about like iMessages or text messages. If you don't mind me veering off the specific topic of conversation. Is that cool?
Go ahead.
All right. So, you know, I have somebody, he's from the community, and, you know, I trust him, but it doesn't even matter because I got a text message from him this morning saying, what is this? And I scroll up and apparently there was a text message, and unfortunately I deleted it, but there was a text message of me. It was from a different service or something, sending a selfie pic of whatever it was. I don't even know, but it was a selfie pic, but it wasn't me. It was just a selfie pic of a stock photo. And I said, I have no idea what that is. I was up at the time last night. It was like 11:20 PM last night, Eastern time. I did not send the text, but he received a text. And he wanted to know what it was. And I said, I don't know. So how could this happen? Like, what is there a way? Like, I don't have any Twitter doesn't have access to my contacts. I don't have. I have given it permission. I nothing. So, is there a way that this can happen? Like, what? It wasn't sent to anybody else. It was just this specific person. Do you have
So
any
after,
thoughts?
first thing, an unfortunate perspective of mine working in so many forensics cases, I've become acutely aware of not assuming anything, right? Because until I just have all the facts, right? But I mean, right off the cuff, though, with that aside, I mean, did you see that? When they asked you what that is, and did you say you scrolled up and you saw that as well as if it came from you, or did you actually never see that?
No, I didn't see it like get sent for me, obviously, right? Because there's no
Well, yeah.
notification. But when he said, "What is this?" I was like, "I don't know." I said, "But don't click on it." That's what I said.
I'd be
And
curious what Sam and Sir Corin think, but my initial thought, and again, I have n no way of saying this is actually what happened. But it kind of sounds like a sim swapping scenario. I don't know. Sam, Sikorin?
yeah, I mean, and for Sir Corin as a pen tester, or with that experience, I'm definitely curious. I'll quickly go through my thoughts, and then I'll get to him. But yeah, I would say it sounds maybe like a sim swapping incident, and yeah, I'm curious about the image, right? Like, I mean, there's a lot of payloads that can be, and historically have been delivered through pictures on Apple devices, or maybe not that many, but there have been a few. And so, yeah, definitely like interacting with it, opening it, saving it. Hopefully this other person didn't do any of those. But yeah, I don't know. SIM swapping could be part of it. I don't know who your carrier is, and you don't have to say it on here. But I know, T-Mobile had a whole big thing. Granted, that's been a very long time ago. By now it should be resolved. But yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, iMessage itself would be it's fairly secure as things go. Certainly a lot better than like SMS in and of itself. But yeah, I would say if anything else, it may be wise to like reset your credentials on your Apple account, like change your password. And if you don't have like a two-factor authentication set up for that alone, it may be worthwhile to do that, just because whether or not that's exactly what it is, it's suspicious enough, I think, to warrant like that step. So, but I'm curious what Sir Corin has, and if he maybe has any insight on what kind of attack method that really might be. If
Sorry, I think I missed a little bit of the initial story. I was dealing with kids. Do you have like a quick summary?
Yeah, quick summary is that there's a person that I've known for a while, and late last night, 11:20 p.m. Eastern time, apparently I sent a text message to this person, and I woke up this morning to a text message from him, a response like, "What is this?" And I looked up and I was like, "I have no idea. I didn't send it." And so I have a I have an iPhone, but it's eSIM, and I didn't send that text at all. So I couldn't tell him what it was. I just told him don't click on it because I didn't send it. And I checked on Twitter to make sure that my permissions they didn't involve contacts, like if somebody hacked into my Twitter or anything like that. But I don't know. It's the first time this has ever happened to me. I'm pretty careful. I have really strong passwords, all that shit, right? You know what I mean? Like, you can't just break into my account normally. So, I'm not saying I'm an expert, but what I'm saying is that I've been really careful over the past, 15 years. So it happened.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm not sure. Like, I know, like, I use Signal a lot, and I have it on my desktop, so I don't know. And I can send messages from that, so it doesn't necessarily have to be like through your phone or your SIM, I think. But I don't know. That's kind of a good question. I honestly have no idea how they would have done something like that.
Well, bizarre.
Well, it's
That's
a
all I'll say.
mystery.
Yeah.
I mean, with the mystery being said, I would say, without obviously having, obviously we don't know, but I would suggest, Jarhead, I would suggest to you to just make sure that you have, again, I don't mean to be repetitive, but I absolutely do not know, but I would check to make sure that you have SIM swapping enabled on your Apple device and contact your carrier maybe and just say, hey, has anybody contacted you lately to try to activate a SIM?
Okay.
Yeah,
Just to be
SIM
safe, just to be
blocking.
safer.
Yeah, SIM locking enabled.
SIM locking, sorry, yeah.
Yeah. No, no, no.
Do not enable SIM swapping.
People SIM swap. No. Yeah, and the only other kind of last thing I would say too is maybe go into your iCloud account. You can do it on your phone, into like other places that you're signed into and other devices, and just make I would say at least go through and make sure that there aren't any unknown devices through there, right? So Corin is absolutely correct. I mean, it may not be SIM swapping. It could just be a possible thing is it could be, that somehow they did get your login credentials and they got to it, from whatever, right? A laptop or some device. But I would just go through and look if to make sure there aren't any unknown devices. On associated with your account, and then yeah, but yeah, I think calling your service provider and asking like, hey, have there been any recent requests for like replacement SIMs or activations of SIMs on my account? But
I'm not familiar with iMessage, but does it encrypt your messages?
it
Well,
does.
it can. You have to have
Cool.
it turned on. I think that there's a basic level and then there's an advanced level.
So are you able, I mean, if you enable that, would you be able to like regenerate your key pair to like, regain some security from that?
Yeah, but you have to pay attention to it, right? And then you have to set up a whole thing of, like basically two or maybe even three factor authentication. Like that's my understanding of it. So Apple's pretty good at this, but at the same time, okay, I'll say this. I just did get an iPad about a month ago that has cellular service. So could it be that? It might be that.
Could be, I don't know.
Okay. Well, I know you guys don't know the exact answers, but I just want to bring it up because the space is specifically about that, if you guys had dealt with any of that, so.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing I guess I would be curious too, and this might be just, and a lot, I mean, it's reaching a little bit, but like, if you've sold devices, so I know that is one thing, and it's true of really any electronic device that you do. And we could get into like what like true wiping advice is, but a recommendation is if you sell a device, right, that you at a minimum you go through and like factory reset everything. Apple generally does pretty well with wiping it. But like if you go to full factory reset, but also like deauthenticating devices from that, right? You sell a phone, or you use it as a trade-in on a new phone, and that you want to, not only do everything you can, at least at a normal level, to like, do a full factory reset, but also to like specifically in your account deauthenticate, like say, hey, I don't want this associated with my account. So I don't know if that has happened, if you did a trade-in to get the tablet. Right, or
No,
if you bought the
no trade
tablet
in.
used, no.
No trade in. Yeah, I don't
Okay.
do that, but yeah, I get your point. Again, I'm pretty careful. I'm just not an expert on this stuff. So that's why I thought it was weird. This is the first time it's ever happened in my entire, smart technology experience, and I've been around since the very beginning. So I thought it was bizarre, but
Yeah, I Jarhead, yeah, and yeah, I mean, there's been a couple of good suggestions, checking with your carrier, SIM locking, checking your credentials, that kind of thing, just to kind of make sure everything's good to go there. But yeah, I appreciate you bringing something up that bringing that kind of thing up. It's always helpful when people bring things like that up in the space, because it gives other people things to consider too and think about that, from an actual real world experience, an example to for them to check out. But yeah, it's always appreciated when people actually when you're willing to bring that up and ask about it. But
Well, you know what? I want to bring up a bigger point. So, most of us, and I'll keep this, pretty brief. Most of us, we conduct our business, whether it's play, for fun on Twitter Spaces or whatever. We're on smartphones, like it's just the way of it. Now, imagine if you're handling something really serious, and I'm not, right? It's just me. This is just Jarhead account. It doesn't mean much, but other people who are involved in Cardano governance and shit like that. What are you doing? What are you storing on your phone? Android, iOS, it doesn't matter. What are you doing? Like, what business are you actually conducting? And what, how are you making it easier to understand these things, to connect in with these things, passwords, so on and so forth? What notes are you making? What are you doing outside of just talking to people in spaces or logging on to different browsers and websites and stuff? Dude, this is serious business with a lot of money at play. It's, you know what I mean? This could be catastrophic. I don't like to throw that word around lightly, but it could be catastrophic,
yep.
to some
It's, I
people.
gonna say, it's funny you use that word because when the, you guys remember like a couple months ago when we catastrophically destroyed the
Yeah.
testnet? Yeah, that was an interesting thing. It's kind of a shame to me that we didn't get to like practice the like we have a Cardano disaster recovery plan, and that was kind of one of the things I was like really hoping we get to test from that to try and like bring it back to life. And something I still
Seriously.
think we should still
Yeah,
something I think we should test.
that's strange, and it's strange that if it wasn't tested, like activated even for a test or whatever to help with the post-mortem on that, and that's interesting it wasn't.
Yeah, it just wasn't done at all. No. Yeah.
I've
Which
kind
is
of had this
very
like
disappointing.
I've kind of had like this backdoor idea of creating like a security minded like fork, like the preview or prod, but call it like the pwn net or the sec net or something, and like intentionally try to do like catastrophic destruction of things, and then like every like I don't know, maybe every quarter or every half year or something, try and recover it.
That
I mean, it's a lot of
sounds
work for
yeah
sure, but
yes.
it would be cool.
Yeah, it would be. Yeah. But yeah, and to that other point, right? I think it's it, like I don't know how to put this, but it's not just blockchain and crypto, but anybody ha anytime somebody creates a small team of just pick five people, they're going to be they're just naturally less focused on security. The cost of it, allocating funds for it, or if they may not even have the funds for it, or they're very, it's usually a very focused mindset of being excited to, hey, I finally developed this thing is actually working. Let's get it out there. Yada, 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 right? And then, I think people need to s slow down a little bit. Maybe that's not a good argument because everybody says Cardano is already slow enough at developing. I don't know. But, the other thing is, if you have small teams, it's and they're all spread out remotely globally, it's very common for people to access their GitHub repos via their mobile device, as just one of many examples, right? And they're not really ensuring that, the platforms that they're developers or whoever their marketing people are using are secure themselves, right? So in small teams, it's even, enterprises as well, but we're talking about small teams right here, right? So it's very important for small teams to ensure their employees are practicing personal security very well, also, right? So making sure that Bob and Nancy are using all these different things, right? Making sure they have the right security functions enabled on their mobile device, making sure they're using 2FA, potentially a security key with FIDO2 and U2F and stuff, and or at least some kind of software authenticator, or ensuring that they're not conducting personal activity with their personal account when they're conducting business activity on that same device, right? if possible, if you can avoid that, right? There's obviously additional cost things that come into that if you're going to help them buy another device for strictly business functions, or no, there's a lot of things out there they can do to help themselves. Okta, right? If you have less than 25 employees, they have free tier services to where you can at least do some extra authentication stuff. I talked earlier about some of the links I shared in the video description. You know, OpenEDR or OWASP Zap or Burp Suite for pen testing and vuln testing and things like that. There's free things out there. I think that teams are all over the blockchain space in general are getting the things done they need to get done first to get whatever thing they're launching launched, and then looking at security, maybe, right? When they don't have anything else happening, I take this stuff very seriously, and I think that is an extremely bad mindset to have.
It's almost like you do this for a living.
Yeah, a lot of
Weird,
them.
right?
But and it does, and I'm gonna go back to this and be everyone's worst enemy. No, but I mean, it comes back to really like a BYOD, all right, or a mo mobile device policy of what are the rules for how you're gonna handle your own devices. And I would say, and maybe this is a little bit of an assumption, but I don't think it is really at all. That probably the vast majority of, especially Cardano, projects or companies, right, have a BYOD practice in large part because many are remote, right? It's like, you've got one person from the US and one person from Germany and somebody from Switzerland or whatever, right? I mean, like you get a team from, very diverse areas, and it's, oh yeah, I've got a computer, right? And you start working, but it is, right? Like, okay, but how are we securing those devices that we're using, right? Because your device that you do your work on for whatever it is, right, is as has already been mentioned, right? But it's also what you play and live and do whatever else. But it comes down to like a policy, like a BYOD policy. However formal or informal that is, but some agreement on what you're going to do, right? Like, and I would go to, and I think I've mentioned it in a space here before, or maybe it was just in a conversation with Macaroni, but like, I came into a financially regulated technology company. They were a small startup. They had four developers and then the CEO, and they had built amazing tech, but they had not had in almost a 2 year span of getting the tech built. They, and this is, they're regulated by they're registered with the SEC and all this, right? So like, but anyway, but like I came in and not all of the devs had two-factor authentication enabled on their GitHub account, right, where they were storing all of this proprietary information and where yeah, anyway, so like, but it was so crazy. Or on their they were using the Google suite, right? And that even there was it, nothing was like, hey, you have to use two-factor authentication. And that to me is like such a simple starter pack of security. Right. And then there's way more that you can go into of how you either, have a VM or a tunnel, like a VPN or something, or VPS or whatever it may be. There are a whole lot more you could go, but there's definitely, I think there, yeah, some discussion, whether it's a formal policy or just an informal discussion about, hey, if you're going to be a part of this, XYZ project or company, like this is what we expect from you to do, right? Or like you mentioned, Macaroni, right? Like it's, hey, take that cut and say we will provide you a device, and that is what you do your work on, and only your work, right?
Yeah, and we've seen a lot of people getting like their Discord accounts hacked lately too, I think, for similar stuff like that, like not securing their own personal devices.
I mean,
Yeah, dude. Yeah, we
Favorite
just saw that
three
with Liquid
network
the other
show?
day.
Or was it, no, JJ Davey, who is a network security guy. I've followed him on LinkedIn, but like among other places, but like he had his Discord hacked. Yeah, anyway, yeah, it's
Yeah, that's interesting, right? Even that's and that's the thing, by the way, right? Even us security experts are still susceptible to being compromised, right? We don't live in some special world, right? We still have to practice all the same security stuff that everybody else does, right? But yeah, and to your point, right? Liquid, just the other, and I mean, consistently, I'm seeing Discord hacks happening, and it's kind of two things, right? One is one of their moderators' account got compromised because they didn't have 2FA on and they had a bad password, right? They just got brute forced. Or the team is set up to where they have, eight different administrators and eight different moderators. So they got 10, 15 people with administrator privileges. And then their user session gets hijacked, regardless of having 2FA enabled and stuff. So then the Discord gets compromised that way. And people aren't, what they're not doing is practicing general security with their Discord server, right? Managing the different security features in there, having different tools or bots in there to help, maybe security bot and security NFT bot or whatever they're called, those kind of things. Or what is a common technique to prevent that kind of attack is to have none of the admins or moderators with admin privileges, and you have an admin cold account, right? So basically, you just have an account that you're never signed in with. You only sign in with it when one of you need to take an administrative action, right? So then you prevent user session attacks like that. And then Twitter accounts. I mean, to your point, right? We're seeing Twitter accounts being hacked left and right. It takes just moments. You could just use Google Authenticator. I mean, I would love for you to use YubiKey or security key, but just use Google Authenticator if you want. It only takes moments to set that up to have two-factor authentication on your Twitter account, right? And then you see, marketing folks for teams A, B, and C, saying, our marketing person's Twitter account got hacked, so if you see anything, avoid it, right? So, yeah, just long-winded, basically repeating what you guys are saying.
No worries. I think there's like a couple different ways you can look at the problem. Like they have like one of them would be like shrinking the attack surface. I think a lot of the Discord stuff, they have a lot of features enabled. Like Discord has a ton of features that most people probably don't even know what they do. I think the Liquid one was like a webhook thing, which probably nobody thought about. I think the other thing that like a lot of crypto projects do with security is there's a lot of focus on securing the product, but not the process. Like people take a ton of look at the code, make sure there's no like, smart contract glitches, order an audit, be paranoid about all that stuff. But like, what are the devs doing on their Discords, their Twitters, their GitHub accounts, all of the stuff that goes into the process of that code, I think, kind of gets overlooked. Again, reiterating stuff we've said.
No, and I'll go on for a third reiteration, but I mean, like I think it is also the acknowledgement, like understanding or acknowledging that these things are inherently not secure. They're not like secure by design, right? So like what you're saying, yeah, absolutely. Like you look at the code, you look at the smart contracts or the interactions, and you say, yeah, we've got to get that absolutely locked tight, right? And I think, there's a lot of really good effort on that, but recognizing like Twitter, right, is not like the most secure any social media, right? And I'm not just picking on Twitter or Discord, but like they're not inherently secure things. And so, right, like maybe a little extra precaution, acknowledging that of how are you going to utilize that, for your company or your project. And yeah, and I think what Eternal was a webhook too, right?
I don't know.
I seem to remember they, but anyway, yeah, I mean, definitely, and I think it's good practice to like pare down, what you need and what you don't need, and this is maybe a little bit going back to the Discord, right? If you have a bot in there and you don't really need it, or you don't understand what it does, or you've enabled the webhook because it does some cool thing, well, right? But you don't understand all of what it might do. I think paring it down to what is required, is essential. And I would extrapolate that to, I think it's true of really any product or service you use, to make sure that you understand why you're adding or doing what you're doing with that thing. And like that it actually serves, that the products you're using are serving a purpose. Going way back to the beginning of the conversation, where Macaroni, you were describing like all these different things, right? You set up logging through various means and EDR and antivirus and whatever else, right? And that's how maybe you capture a lot of this data in how you're detecting, preventing and detecting an incident, right? It also matters what you're measuring, like know what you're measuring, right? Like if your logs aren't giving you enough, if they're not giving you the right information, right? If they're giving you too much, and even with, AI assisted software or, or automation or whatever, you're not able to get the information or understand it in a way that you can take action on, then go back and look at it, right? Do we need this logged, or are we logging the right things, right? Do we know what the parameters are on them? Are they too tight, too loose? Anyway, it really does become a lot, especially when everybody on a small project or startup company, like you said before, and I know this is just repeating, but like, right, they're focused on getting their product into deployment, into live status, and they're looking at making some kind of a profit or whatever the purpose is, right? But at least cover their costs, right? Or making money, and so all the other things that were regarding security can seem like a detractor or a distraction from that, but I think it makes a huge difference when something happens.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think really what we've been talking over the last little while is kind of like, breaking it down to a simple thought process of saying, in a progressive security manner, right? So you're continuously adding to your layered security, right? So you look at thing A saying, well, this is a potential problem. Let's solve it. Then you go to thing B, you solve that. Then you go to thing C, you solve that, right? I get a lot of questions from people who are saying, hey, what are all the things I need to do right this moment, right? I need to do all of these things right now. And I think that's not always the best approach because you'll miss a lot of stuff. You'll get very overwhelmed. You might get detracted from continuing that effort, those kinds of things, right? So, taking a lot of things we're talking about and just slowly improving your security, finding that, if I had one suggestion for small teams is take the most high value thing that you have and secure that, then branch off from there. Right. If you're low on team members and low on funds and you don't have a lot of time, do that, right? Take the most high value assets that you have, secure those. And then, like I said, just continue from there. Yeah, that's just my thoughts that I had based on what you guys were just sharing. So, at some point I'll probably end this space sometime in the relatively near future here, but I just want to open the floor now and just see if Sam or Jarhead or Sikorn, or if Jar Jar or Josh, you guys still want to hop up. Just if you guys have any other thing that you want to talk about or share or bring up, it doesn't even have to be related to the topic. Just anything else that you guys may have had on your mind that you wanted to, that you considered wanting to bring up here.
I don't have a lot of cybersecurity questions, but that's kind of the problem, right? With most of the community. But at the same time, when you have something funky happen, I think a space like this is very valuable. You know what I mean? You get to ask these questions.
I was
Sorry, I was just going to suggest like another thing. If you're like a a defender, a blue team, or whatever, and you're trying to secure your environment, I would make sure to test your detection capability. I think a lot of people rely too heavily on their detection tools. Like, oh, it's going to detect things, and then I'll investigate after that. But there's a lot of times that things sneak past your detection tools. Like, people would be surprised at how easy it is to sneak things past detection tools. A lot of time you can just change, like, a byte to change the hash signature or whatever, sneak a payload through it or something. So, like, if you're going to test it, like, just tell your CISO or whoever's in charge first, and then, make sure that the guys that reset your passwords or unblock your IP know ahead of time, and then just run some normal like Nmap or some, Bloodhound, any of those pen testy tools. Just try a couple different payloads and see what makes it through and what doesn't, and then just confirm that your detection tools on a regular basis work. Just another 2 cents to add.
That's a good point, right? It's not security solutions are not a set and forget thing, right? Yeah, completely agree, Sir Kern. Sam, what do you got, sir?
Yeah, so let's see. I mean, not a whole lot, I think, for just a short little bit. I mean, I think hopefully enough was covered, that is a value for either the people who have been in here or that listen to it later on. I had a thought, now I lost it. Let me think if I can remember it, but I might not. I don't know.
Yeah, go ahead and take a moment and think about it while I just respond to Jarhead too. When you said, yeah, Jarhead, thanks for sharing that. And honestly, these spaces do have topics, but more importantly, if somebody joins this space and has a question or wants to talk about something, just like you shared your thing earlier, Jarhead, this is to help people out. So if you have any question whatsoever, we are here to help you, right? And we will help you figure it out. You can reach out to me literally anytime, 7 days of all 7 days of the week, if you have a security concern or question or anything like that. And I will do my best to either give you the answer or provide you the direction on what to look into, whatever it is. And I'm, not speaking for Sam or Corin or anybody else, but I'm pretty sure they would do their best to help you as well. So, yeah, Sam, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I remembered it. And yeah, absolutely. Jarhead, Snapchat me. No, just kidding. I'll use that. Anyway. okay. So what I remembered, and this really comes out of a activity that I am passionate about, I love, and that's threat modeling. But one of the things that is discussed in threat modeling is that anytime you identify anything, right, a potential threat or vulnerability or whatever, right, log it. Even if you're not going to take action on it right now, right, or you decide that because of A, B, C, you already have countermeasures in place to prevent it, or I think it was, Sir Corin said it, like, it's just so complex that it would take, 1,000 years for that potential vulnerability or whatever threat to be realized, right? No matter why you don't take action on it, log it, right? Write it down in some kind of a tracker, whether you're using like Jira or use an Excel spreadsheet, right? But like, just somehow record what it is and why you didn't take action. And I think not only for threat modeling, but I think for this too, right? There's a lot to focus on, right? Alert fatigue is a real thing. Macaroni, you mentioned it, right? Like, you're either responding to so many different things that eventually you get fatigued, you burn out, right? But I think whatever it is, like, if you have a concern such as like, hey, how are our remote team connecting to our enterprise solutions, right? Like the GitHub or the Discord or whatever, right? Write it down, keep it in a tracker somewhere that everybody can see. Hopefully, and that's also protected, because that might reveal, right, some of your potential vulnerabilities, but like even if you don't take action, write it down, because either A, you know, like you said, Macaroni, later on, maybe you have the bandwidth or the attention to address whatever that thing is. Or, you know, it's just on your, it's on your radar and you keep it on your radar, even if it's not in like the current sprint or, you know, it's not like something you're actively working on, just so you don't forget it later on. I think it applies in threat modeling. I think it applies kind of here as well.
Absolutely, Sam. Absolutely, man. My train of thought has just stopped. Oh, look, we have a requester here. Who do we got? Josh. Hey, you've been, you, Josh, you have, well, I'll wait for you to hop up. But yeah, you've been listening the entire time. Thank you. For participating. What's going on?
Hey, so I picked up this little tip from a colleague of mine. What he does is he keeps all of his crypto assets on a dedicated device, and that's the only thing that he uses that device for. And I've adopted the same thing. I picked up a device, and I keep my own crypto assets there, and that's the only thing that I use that for. There's no emails or social media or anything that ever touches that device. It's meant to be just completely separate. And I'm sure there's some benefits that could come about doing that for maybe like a Discord server, having a dedicated device that has like an ownership account on there that you only use for you know, changing up permissions and adding accesses and those kinds of things. My question is, and the mistake that I don't want to make in, you know, trying to practice good security and all that stuff is to stop thinking about crypto security. So with that scenario, with that, those conditions that I laid out, what are some potential vulnerabilities or things that I should think about or be aware of in that practice that might help me to take additional precautions or better secure myself from those conditions that I laid out?
Sam or anybody, if you want to answer that, you can. I was actually responding to someone asking me a security question in Discord, so I was very rudely not listening to you, Josh. But if you do want to take like 10 seconds and just list out those conditions one more time,
yeah.
My apologies.
And I would also ask just for further clarification, because I was listening. No, just outplayed. But so just for further clarification, you are looking for recommendations on like how you described essentially your, you know, compartmentalizing your crypto interaction, or you mentioned like Discord. I don't know if there is more in there. Which part are you maybe looking for more security focused concentration?
So,
or
yeah, the parameters, the conditions that I'm referring to is basically just using a specific dedicated device for things, whether it's, you know, managing a Discord ownership account. Or managing my own crypto assets on that dedicated device. I guess the thing that I'm thinking about is there's a dedicated device. It's only used for a specific purpose. Nothing else gets in there, social media or anything. You know, are there any additional precautions that I could take to further secure that device, or make sure that like that is, you know, what vulnerabilities do you foresee,
right,
for yeah, a dedicated device? You know, what things should I be thinking about or be aware of in that?
So I'll give you a quick thought, and then Sam, I'll let you amplify. So, you know, they're generally speaking, from a business perspective, right? The best thing to do broadly is to have separate devices for business and personal functions, right? So that they don't intermingle in case something personal gets corrupted, or compromised, then that could lead to a business compromisation, right? Obviously, keeping those separate are key. And anything that I mention, obviously, there's always financial concerns to consider as well, because if you have two devices, double the cost, right? Depending on, well, I guess, what you get, relatively speaking, right? But from a personal perspective, and this is actually going to be, this is something I might add next week, but Sam and I were talking, and I think the topic next week is going to be kind of like a personal continuity plan, if you will, right? So, Josh, if you want to participate next week, that actually may be a very good focus area for next week. But from a personal perspective, some things that I think are vulnerability points that I think people miss a lot are they'll sign into all of their applications on their mobile device. On that exact same mobile device, they will have their two-factor authentication method, right? So Google Authenticator, for example. So you log into Twitter on your, you know, I have a Samsung Android device. So I log into my Android device. I log into Twitter on my Android. Also on the same one, what if I have my Google Authenticator on there on the exact same device where I'm two-factor authenticating, right? That is a potential, you know, risk and a security gap right there, right? Or a security flaw, because if my mobile device gets compromised, they have my account plus my 2FA, right? Then you have your crypto transactions. I have several different systems. I have actually, if I'm counting, six different computers in my office right now, three servers and two laptops, right? And each one of them does something different, right? One, I might just do documentation stuff on Excel sheets and things like that, and maybe bills. Then the other one is where I do all my degenerate stuff and crypto transactions and things like that. I'm not logging into anything else, not my bank accounts or nothing else at all, ever. But I, obviously, I'm aware of the fact that not everybody has that many devices, right? But I think, to summarize my point there, I think one vulnerable gap to consider is doing multiple things on the exact same device, right? Whether that's multiple authentication methods or multiple different functions, whether it's crypto transaction, banking transaction, and using social media, things like that. But Sam, I'm sure you definitely have some other good thoughts. Go ahead.
Yeah. So,
or Sir Coin, you had your hand up too. Either one of you guys want to go first. Go ahead.
You can go first. Doesn't matter to me.
Okay. All right. I appreciate that. So, you know, I would start with two thoughts, and then just a couple of like pointer observations. So, one, the first thought is, as with anything, and I have certainly said it, and Macaroni's said it over past spaces as well, right? But like, know what you can commit to, right? So like, before you get super deep into like, you know, Fort Knox level, whatever, the type of security for things, like know what you can commit to, like what is reasonable for a security posture, whether that's personal or professional slash enterprise, right? That you can manage in an effective way over time, right? Potentially indefinitely. And so like that has to be, you know, like the first thought, because there's, you know, I'm sure between, you know, Macaroni and I, and with Sir Corn as well, and some of the other people that come in the space, right? There's a ton of things that we could say, do this and do that and do whatever, right? Some might be vague or broad in their nature for like broad security concepts, and some are maybe are specific to your case, but you have to know what can you do, like what are you willing to accommodate, and the other thing is like really focusing on what is the most valuable. We mentioned that with the incident response, right? And as you kind of prepare for that on an enterprise level, I would echo what Macaroni said, right? Like come back next week, because that is going to be kind of a continuation of this week's topic, but it's going to be focused on more of a personal level and less of enterprise, you know, project, company, team, whatever. saying all that, just some super highlights, right? I mean, there are things that you can do with just one system. So if you have like the one device that you do all your crypto stuff on, and then you have your one normal device that you do everything else on, I mean, there are things, you know, like Macaroni said, you know, with the credentials, having everything contained on one device may potentially have some vulnerabilities. And some of those could be like, you know, when you log into a website or a service, and let's say you have two-factor authentication on, you know, there's typically a little check mark that says, remember me or remember this device, right? And then it won't ask you again for your two-factor authentication, either forever. Some services are like that, or they'll do it like remember for 30 days. It is, I'll admit, right? It's a little bit of a small pain, but I always make sure that that's unchecked because every time I log in, well, there's really two reasons, but every time I log in, I want that it has to, that I have to enter my two-factor authentication. For me, you know, on virtually anywhere that I can, that's a physical YubiKey device, a physical security token. But at least it's, you know, the time-based one-time password or normal 2FA. But I do that, right? For privacy reasons, it's also that if you say to remember me, they put a cookie and they'll remember the device. But anyway, that's not here or there for this specific thing. But yeah, like also saving your credentials. Like if you save your login credentials in your browser, then you just have to have your browser compromised. And not to make it sound too trivial, but I mean, but that's the level. They just need to compromise your browser that you're connecting to the internet from. And then, you know, like Macaroni said, they've got everything, right? They've got all your passwords, all your 2FA, if you're just saving it within Chrome. But the last thing I'll say just is, yeah, like understand what you want to do. There is a term or a concept, right, called compartmentalization. And there's a lot of ways that it's applied, right? That generally means that you might have, you know, whatever, like an email, if you will, that you have one email that you just do all your online shopping and whatever on, and then you have another email that you use to sign up for newsletters and, you know, kind of those peripheral services that aren't like super important. And then you have one that's like all you have on there is like banking related things, like your maybe your bills, your bank, right? But like you compartmentalize that way. That way, if one email and its credentials are compromised for whatever reason, right? Like they only get access to whatever's in that silo. But the concept of compartmentalization, I said that really weird, the compartmentalization is, it can be applied to other ways, right? Like Macaroni was saying, right? He's got multiple devices. And that may be a good way, right? It sounds like you're already kind of doing that with your compartmentalized, all your crypto activity to one device. But when it comes to like Discord or other things, and if I remember correctly, I know at one time you were a Meld ambassador and a few other things, and you've got your YouTube channel. Right. And like, so anyway, but like you might say, okay, I want to compartmentalize X, right? Like this focus part of my life, I want to make sure that that's isolated. You can do it through another device, or if you don't know, and if you do, I'm not trying to insult your intelligence. If you don't know, learn how to set up virtual machines, and you can get a lot of value out of like what Macaroni was saying with like six devices just by using virtual machines, right? Maybe there's a virtual machine that you spin up, and that's all you do is you interact with your YouTube channel or whatever else, right? Or you have another virtual machine that you do X, right? I mean, so you can do that. Right. The great thing is, of course, it takes up space on your hard drive because each one, depending on what operating system you use, is going to be potentially right 20, 30 to 100 plus gigabytes of data that it'll hold. But you can have a whole bunch spun up, or not spun up, but like just saved, created, and then you design it for that specific purpose. And then when you want to do X, you just spin up that specific virtual machine and you do your thing, right? And you can pick a comfortable operating system for you, right? If you're a Windows user, you can just make 2, 3, 4 other Windows VMs. Of course, those do take up the most space. But if you're comfortable with Linux, right, then you can spin up some Linux ones and have them purpose built like that. And maybe for whatever your most sensitive one, right, you pick a very solid operating system and lock it down, right? And I know I'm probably going long for Macaroni. He wants to close it up. So I'll stop there. And then I'll let Sir Cohen go before we wrap it up, maybe.
Thanks, sure, Amy. Go ahead, Sir Cohen.
Yeah, so I think one of the things Sam mentioned was talking about like all the different kind of browser stuff. And like as a pen tester, I can assure you that browser vulnerabilities where like you steal somebody's cookies or you trick their browser into performing some action that they don't want, those are probably the two most common vulnerabilities I find all the time. It's a cross-site scripting and cross-site request forgery is what they're called. Super, super common. So that's generally why people suggest to use a hardware wallet. The other thing I was going to say for your specific conditions you're talking about, Josh, I would say to beware of like a single point of failure. Like it's great advice to definitely be using one device for like all the specific stuff, like the Chinese wall, you know, separation of duties type stuff. That's like super good advice. Just have like a backup plan for like, you know, what happens if your hardware gets bricked, your hard drive gets bricked, you know, your computer gets burnt down to fire, or even some like kind of time sensitive thing where like, you know, you could be on a trip or are driving somewhere and don't have it with you and you've got like a Indigo or a Liquid position open, you find out you're about to get liquidated because the market's taking a dump and you need to make a quick transaction. Just like have a backup plan or just at least think about what might be need to be done if you can access that one device that you use for everything specifically. So, yeah, that's kind of my two cents with that.
Fantastic.
Yeah, they are. Go ahead, Josh.
I was just going to say there's a lot there that I'm going to go ahead and implement, and I will definitely be there next week.
Awesome, man. Looking forward to it. Yeah, that would be awesome to have your participation in that. And I really like hearing your perspective, Sir Corn, on those common vulnerabilities that you see there. That's great stuff. All right. If anybody else has anything, Jarhead, Josh, Corn, Sam, or anything, interrupt me. I don't mind keep going if you have something else still on your mind while I'm closing up here. But I will go ahead and close up. So I appreciate everybody joining today and participating and sharing your thoughts and listening and so on and so on. I think this is very valuable, and I hope that people that listen to this recording get a lot of value out of this. I do get people, like I say all the time, I get people messaging me all the time saying, you know, they love listening to the recordings, they just don't join the spaces, so they do get a lot of value out of it. So I think that's it. Thanks again. I hope everybody has a great rest of your Sunday, and we'll talk next week. Take care.
Cool beans. Take care, everybody.
All right. Have a good one.